Hey, you're listening to Zentertainment Talk Radio on the web at www.zentertainment.org. My name is Joe Davidson. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm glad that you're here. The relentless search for high self-esteem. You know, it's become a religion in our culture. We're so competitive, and this search for high self-esteem, it tells us that we have to be special and way above average in order to feel good about ourselves. But there's always somebody richer, somebody more attractive, somebody more successful. And even when we do manage to feel self-esteem for that one golden perfect moment, we can't hold on to it. It's like our sense of self-worth, it just bounces around like a ping pong ball, rising up and falling in step with our latest success or our latest failure. Is there something that's a little more stable than this? Yes, self-compassion. Today we're going to talk about self-compassion and how to stop beating yourself up and leave insecurity behind. My guest today is Dr. Kristen Neff. She's a psychologist and she's an associate professor in human development at the University of Texas in Austin. Many of you know part of her story. Her husband, Rupert Isaacson, was on the show several weeks ago and we talked about his book, his audiobooks, and the adventure he went on with Kristen and their little boy, Rowan, who has autism, when they went to Mongolia. So I'm really excited to have her on the show. And by the way, if this is the first time that you have listened, please sign up for the free newsletter on the show page at zentertainment.org. I'd love to keep in touch with you about upcoming episodes. So this is Kristen Neff, and her book is called Self-Compassion.
The problem is not with having self-esteem itself, and certainly it's not healthy to have low self-esteem, to hate yourself, or to think you're unworthy, but the problem is what do you do to get high self-esteem and keep it? Again, as you say, because in this culture we need to be special and above average to feel okay about ourselves, that means we're in a constant process of social comparison, trying to find ways to kind of puff up our own egos, and put others down. There's actually a phenomena that they call in social psychology the Lake Wobegon effect, where most people think they're above average on almost any trait you think of. You know, they're better drivers than others, or nicer than others, they're more intelligent than others. So we really try to see ourselves as better than others so we can feel good about ourselves. The problem is, of course, is eventually, inevitably, you run into someone who is better than you on a particular trait. We can't be above average on every single dimension of life. So when that happens, our self-esteem takes a nosedive. So that's one of the problems, is self-esteem is contingent on success, on being better than others, which means it tends to go up and down depending on our latest comparison or our latest success or failure.
Is self-compassion more stable than self-esteem?
What I try to argue, and what in fact the research shows, is that self-compassion offers the same benefits of self-esteem. People with self-compassion are less depressed, less anxious, they're happier, they're more optimistic, just like people with high self-esteem. But it doesn't have the same downsides. People don't need to compare themselves to others. They just have to feel like they're a human being connected to others. They aren't narcissistic the way a lot of people with self-esteem are, very narcissistic. Just as an aside, they've been tracking increases in narcissism along with the increased emphasis on self-esteem in the schools. And narcissism levels are basically through the roof. They're the highest ever recorded. So self-compassion doesn't require you to feel better than other people. It doesn't require you to defend your ego. With self-esteem, often we blame other people for our problems because it's too painful to admit that we aren't perfect. With self-compassion, you don't have to do that. And again, we have data showing that compared to self-esteem, for instance, people who are self-compassionate take more responsibility for past mistakes. At the same time, they're less upset by them.
How do you pursue excellence and compete and still have self-compassion?
Right. So what the research shows is that people who are self-compassionate, their standards are just as high as everyone else's. They aim just as high, but they don't get as upset when they don't meet their standards. Okay. So it's really how you react when you don't do as well as you'd like, even though you can still try very hard. And in fact, in some ways, people with self-compassion, they try even harder than those who criticize themselves, because if you have self-compassion, you're much less afraid of failure. You can trust that if you fail, you'll treat yourself kindly and with understanding. If you're a habitual self-critic, you can trust that if you fail, you will beat yourself up. The whole motivational power of self-compassion comes from caring about yourself, comes from the desire to alleviate your suffering and to fulfill your potential. And that means that you're going to try to achieve your dreams if that's going to make you happy. Now, your dreams may be different. Maybe you don't necessarily want to be that Wall Street broker who earns $5 million a year. I mean, maybe you would decide, you know, some other career path would make you happier. But you certainly, and again, there's lots of research showing that people with high levels of self-compassion are really oriented towards personal growth because they care about themselves. They want to be happy.
One of the things I loved in your book so much is that you open up about yourself personally. And you know, it was really interesting. You wrote about your first marriage ending, and you wrote openly about an affair you had, some of the weaknesses that were in your marriage. And I realized that when I was reading it, I didn't feel one single drop of judgment towards you or anything. I mean, there was nothing. It was just, oh, this is her story. Cool, she's sharing it. And then I thought, wow, you know, why is it so much easier to feel compassion for somebody else and so hard to feel it for ourselves?
Yeah, and that was, you know, I was really debating whether or not to write that story. But I realized that, A, if I can't come across as perfect, as not being someone who really needs self-compassion or needed self-compassion, then that wouldn't be honest. And I also knew that it would help, you know, connect to readers that this really helped me actually in my life. And I did judge myself at first, and that is precisely when I discovered self-compassion, when I started going to a Buddhist meditation group. And because it allowed me to deal with my incredible, really self-hate, I considered myself a very moral person. I would never, ever, ever have thought I would do that. But again, it allowed me to see that I was human, I made mistakes, and that in a way, having the affair, breaking out of the marriage, part of me did it because I wanted to be happy, and I wasn't happy, but I didn't even realize it because I was so emotionally shut down. One part of me was just happier, I think, than I'd ever been in my life with this man that I was having the affair with. But I had so much shame that I couldn't face it. So it was like I was almost, you know, at a split personality or something. The other side of me, when I was interacting with my husband, just, you know, it was very shut down, and I just couldn't go there. I couldn't face it. And again, I think that's one of the beautiful powers of self-compassion, is when you know that you aren't going to tear yourself to shreds, that you can say things like, well, I'm human and I make mistakes and, you know, life is difficult. It allows you the freedom to see yourself clearly. And when you see yourself clearly, then you can make changes that, you know, help yourself and stop harming others. And that ability to see yourself clearly is so important for living a happy and a moral life.
I was thinking about how so many people judge others harshly, like to tear down celebrities that they see falling. And usually that's because of their own dark shadows they can't handle looking at. And I was also wondering if you could talk a little bit about how we judge ourselves black and white as good or bad.
You know, that's really one of the problems with self-esteem. It's an estimation, a judgment, an evaluation of our self-worth. It does tend to be pretty simplistic. I am good or I am bad, especially in the moment of either success or failure. I am good, I am bad. Self-compassion doesn't evolve evaluation. There is no judgment involved in self-compassion. It's a feeling you have. It's a way of relating to yourself that's equally relevant when you're on top of the world or when you've fallen flat on your face. So it's always available. And instead of thinking of yourself a certain way, defining yourself a certain way, you're actually just relating to yourself with kindness. And that's its power. It almost happens below the level of thought itself.
I wanted to ask you something else. In life, I think this is a big part of the self-help movement of always trying to be happy, but we think if we're honest that life is supposed to go really well, and when some huge catastrophe comes along or loss, whatever it is, hardship, that something has gone terribly wrong.
Yeah, and that's so I've got my model of self-compassion as different components to it, and you know the most obvious one is self-kindness versus self-judgment. But also very, very important is framing your experiences in light of the shared human experience as opposed to feeling isolated when things go wrong. And when something does go badly wrong in your life, or you notice something about yourself you really don't like, irrationally, you don't think this with your rational mind, but emotionally you react as if it's just me. It's only me who's going through this. Somehow everyone else in the world is perfect or they have dandy lives. Again, you don't actually think this, but emotionally feel that. It's almost as if, you know, hey, this isn't the plan I signed up for. You know, I signed up for the I will be perfect and life will be perfect plan, and something has gone terribly wrong. When in fact, that is a plan you signed up for. It's a plan we all signed up for. And when you remember that, you can actually feel more connected to other people when you fail or something goes wrong, because you realize we all go through this. It's not just me. This is a human experience. We're all in this together.
Let's talk a little bit more about self-indulgence.
Yeah, this is really important because I find in my research and just talking to people that the fear of self-indulgence is the number one reason people aren't more compassionate to themselves. They really think that their self-criticism is necessary to motivate themselves, and that if they were kind to themselves, they would basically let themselves get away with anything. It's absolutely not true. In fact, the reverse is true. Self-criticism is a lousy motivator, okay? When we criticize ourselves, first of all, we get depressed. Self-criticism and depression go hand in hand. And as we all know, depression is not exactly a motivational mindset, right? The other thing about self-criticism is it causes us to lose faith in ourselves. And all the research on motivation says, you know, a great proportion of our achievement depends on how self-confident we are. And if you cut yourself down and say, I'm stupid and I'm lame and I'm worthless, you're going to lose self-confidence. That's also going to undermine you. And then the other thing, again, is if you're self-critical, you're going to be very afraid of failure because it'd be so painful if you failed. So people who are self-critical tend to procrastinate more, for instance, to have an excuse for failure. They don't take learning risks. So with self-compassion, the motivational power of self-criticism comes from fear, the fear of self-judgment. The motivational power of self-compassion comes from love. There's a difference between taking personal responsibility and judgment. Some people in the literature, in the scientific literature, draw the distinction between shame and guilt. Guilt is saying, you know, I really harmed someone, or I really harmed myself. I feel bad about that. I want to repair the situation. Shame is, I'm so horrible. I'm a terrible person. So guilt is other focused, right? Again, it kind of depends how you define guilt, but this type of guilt is, oh no, I hurt you. How can I help you, or how can I apologize or make things better? Shame is very self-focused. I am terrible, you know, I'm unworthy. It's not really thinking about the other person. So with self-compassion, if you mess up, when you can accept the fact that you're only human and you messed up, then you stop thinking about yourself and you're better able to think about fixing or repairing what you did. And you have to remember, once you've done something, once it's in the past, there is nothing you can do about it, right? All you really have to have the power to do in any moment is to try to shape your future moments. So if in the past you did something wrong, or you hurt someone, or you hurt yourself, if you forgive yourself without beating yourself up, and then you can move on and focus on how can I make the next moment better. If you criticize yourself and especially go round and round and round, I was so terrible, I was so horrible, you're stuck in the past, you're putting yourself in a negative mindset, and you're less able to impact the future moment positively.
Let's talk a little bit about rumination and how to break the cycle of that.
Your mind is stuck on something, it gets stuck in this black goo, you can't free yourself. And actually, women are twice as likely to ruminate than men. It's probably partly our biochemistry that does that. So when you criticize yourself, you feed the cycle of rumination. You're feeding the negativity. You just get stuck in this black hole and you can't get out. What happens when you're compassionate towards yourself is you break the cycle. You break the cycle of negativity because, in fact, compassion is a positive emotion. Kindness, connectedness, those are positive emotions, and they help. They don't get rid of the negative emotions, but it's like you wrap them in the embrace of the positive emotions so they have less power.
That leads me to another thought. A lot of people want to get rid of suffering and get rid of negative emotions. Can you talk a little bit about that? Why does that not work when you try to push them aside?
All the research shows, and if anyone here has practiced Buddhist meditation, one of the main tenets, which seems to be true, is the more you resist something, the more powerful it becomes, right? There's, you know, the term, what you resist persists. Or another saying is suffering equals pain times resistance. In other words, pain is inevitable. The more you resist the pain, the more you say, this should not be happening. I should not be this way. Then you create all this add-on suffering. So the reality is you can't get rid of negative emotions. You can't get rid of pain. The more you try to get rid of them with that resistant energy, actually the stronger and the more persistent they will become. So the only option we have really, you know, it might be nice if we can snap our fingers and make them go away, but for whatever reason, life wasn't designed that way. So really the only option is to relate to our pain with compassion, with kindness, with the desire to do whatever we can to alleviate our suffering. But it has to really unfold on its own. You know, all we can do is plant the seeds of kindness, plant the seeds of happiness, and water those seeds, and then hopefully something new will grow.
I read this in your book, and I thought this is so true, that a lot of suffering is when our ideals of how things should be are drastically different from how they actually are in that moment.
Exactly. It's comparing the reality of the present moment to how we want things to be that causes suffering. Now remember, you know, nothing exists except the present moment. The past doesn't exist anymore. The future hasn't happened yet. So once we're in the present moment, this is it. There is no alternate reality. This is all we have to work with. The only power we really have is to try to shape the next moment. We can't absolutely control it. I mean, for all we know, a tornado hits in 5 seconds and, you know, that's it. You can't control it. But again, you can plant seeds. You can do whatever you can to try to make the next moment, you know, a happier one.
There was an exercise in your book. I called it the triangle exercise, but you said it was let me see if I can remember the exact words. The criticizer, the one being criticized, and the compassionate observer, something like that. But I did it, and that was when I realized that as self-compassionate as I thought I was, I've still been wrestling with some critical voices. And I wondered if you could share a little bit about that exercise with everybody.
Yeah, it's actually based on, in Gestalt therapy, they have a Gestalt two-chair exercise where you have the criticizer and the criticized have a dialogue. So just the difference is adding in a third chair that has compassion, not only for the part of you that's criticized, but also the criticizer. You really see, why do we criticize ourselves? Is it because we're bad people? In fact, the reason we criticize ourselves is because we want to be safe. We really think, and we are taught, that if we don't criticize ourselves and try to keep ourselves in line, we will be harmed. So you really need to have a lot of compassion for the self-critical voice, just as you need to have compassion for the part of you that's so hurt. And the compassionate voice just really tries to find a different way. Let's just, you know, orthogonally, just go down a whole new dimension.
It's neat because you can, well, here's what I did. I wrote down, honestly, what some of the critical voices were that I was hearing in that moment or that I'd been aware of that day. I just wrote them down. It was maybe like 7-8 things that stood out. Then I wrote how it felt to hear those things. Then the compassionate observer part of me, I wrote down, and I realized that the part that was criticizing me was actually trying to stretch me to meet my goals and to be who I could be, but it was just really doing it in the wrong, totally wrong way. And it was doing it in a way that it had the opposite effect, right?
Criticism, like you say, doesn't really work. And the way to recognize this that most of us can do is think about what would a really kind, caring, compassionate parent say to their child if they wanted to help them. If a mother wanted to motivate her child, let's say who came home with a poor exam grade, if she tells him he's stupid, lazy, worthless, it's not going to work at all. So what would she say? What words would she use? Luckily, most of us are pretty darn good at being compassionate to others. We're pretty practiced. We tend to be compassionate to our friends when they have something go wrong. If you're a parent, you've probably learned to be compassionate toward your children or your spouse. So I always tell people, draw on what you know, draw on your strengths. Imagine that you were a friend of yours or a child. What would you say to yourself if you were a really close friend that you cared about? You know the language to use. You know putting the supportive arm around your friend's shoulder. Well, you can actually do that to yourself. There's an amazing amount of research that shows compassionate touch. It's really soothing and calming. It actually releases oxytocin and opiates, the feel-good hormones. It lowers cortisol. You know, that's the reason we compassionately touch others, and that's why it really helps to, you know, give yourself a hug or stroke your arm or, you know, whatever feels comfortable for you. But draw on your strengths. You know how to do it. You just have to learn to turn around and apply it towards yourself.
You know, sometimes if you're talking to somebody who you're close to, just putting your hand on top of the other or their hand on top of yours while you're sharing something or talking, it's kind of amazing how it softens.
Yeah, when I talk about self-compassion to groups, I often have them do this little experiential exercise so they can feel the different emotions. So what I have them do is first you take your both arms out straight at your sides, making a T, and you clench your fists really hard. And you do that for about 3 seconds, all right? So it's tense and painful. And that's what self-criticism feels like. And then you release your fists and open your hands. And that's what dropping self-criticism feels like. Feels a lot freer. But then you take your hands and put them gently over your heart. And that's what compassion feels like. And so you really need all three to drop self-criticism, but also actively, consciously soothe and comfort yourself. And again, this has a physiological basis. As mammals, you know, maybe you think you can't be self-compassionate, but as mammals, we are born with the ability both to give and receive care, right? It's part of the mammalian brain. So what you need to do is tap into that, get out of the reptilian brain, which is fight or flight. And of course, when you criticize yourself, you are both the attacker and the attacked, which means you get stressed, which means you get anxious. So there's research showing that self-compassion actually reduces cortisol and releases these feel-good hormones and makes your body feel safe. And of course, we make so much, our decisions are so much wiser and more productive when we feel safe than when we feel frightened.
You talked about the brain a little bit. It reminded me of a question I had. The amygdala is the oldest part of the brain, and you know, it kind of is designed to quickly detect threats in our environment. Sometimes it seems like patterns or past experiences can get locked into it.
Yeah, well, there's several research teams that are starting to look at self-compassion for vets with PTSD. We don't have a lot of research yet. There's some indication that it does help. Certainly, there's a very, very strong negative link between self-compassion and anxiety. Again, what happens with self-compassion is you move most of your energy from the amygdala to the parts of the brain. There's actually research showing that different parts of the brain light up when you criticize yourself and when you give yourself compassion. So you're moving the energy of your brain, basically. You're activating those parts of your brain that are associated with caregiving. And again, reducing cortisol, et cetera. So there really is something you can do. I mean, I tell people it's, you know, and maybe I'd say this to anyone suffering from panic attacks, just try it. Try hugging yourself. Try gently putting your hands over your heart. I'm not saying it's going to magically go away, but it actually might help because you're changing your physiology in that moment. We all need to feel safe to be happy. And self-compassion makes us feel safe, cared for, you know, connected to other people in terms of common humanity. And feeling safe runs directly counter to the fear associated with anxiety.
In your book, you talked about some more personal things like your family background and your relationship with your father. How did that influence how you felt about yourself when you were younger? And how did you come to a place to sort of heal that?
Yeah, so my dad left when I was about 3. He tuned in, dropped out, became a hippie, moved to Maui. We lived near Los Angeles. And my story's so common. I think so many girls have this issue. I mean, obviously boys too, but I think for girls it manifests in a certain way. I call it the hurt little girl pattern. When I was younger, and certainly when I was an adolescent, I just kept on picking the wrong guys. I had a lot going for me in high school, and I only chose the guys who eventually rejected me. And somehow I was trying to play out my mind a new pattern where maybe this time I'll get a guy who stays. And of course, I never did. And so it's really with self-compassion that I was able to work through a lot of those issues and let go of that feeling of being hurt all the time. It doesn't ever go away. It still pops up now and again, not nearly as often, but it is at some level part of my formed personality. So whenever it comes up, I just give myself compassion and I give myself what my father wasn't able to give me at the time.
Self-compassion, especially for women in regards to body image.
The number one domain in which women base their self-esteem is physical appearance. And women tend to be incredibly hard on themselves in terms of looks and how thin they are and, you know, is their nose perfect, etc. And so what happens with self-compassion, you know, I don't think it's the case that you stop caring about that, but you really are better able to focus on health and well-being, okay? So for instance, there's research showing women with self-compassion exercise for the right reasons. They exercise because they want to be healthy, not because they want to look a certain way or help other people. Or impress other people. There is research showing that women on diets, when they blow their diet, if they're taught to be self-compassionate, they're actually more likely to stick to their weight loss goals than those who beat themselves up. If you criticize yourself when you blow your diet, you're going to be upset and you're going to eat to make yourself feel better. You're going to lose faith in yourself. But if you're self-compassionate, you say, okay, I blew it. I shouldn't have eaten that. But again, I want to be healthy. And if you aren't feeling healthy in your body, you're going to be unhappy, and self-compassion doesn't want you to be unhappy. So it will keep you motivated to exercise, to not gain too much weight. But you really do it out of wanting to be healthy, not because you have to be perfect. I mean, even supermodels have cellulite. I know some. They just airbrush it out. Perfection is not actually possible. So basing your self-worth on how you look, really destructive path. Self-esteem is very limited. You know, let's face it, we all base our self-esteem to some degree on our looks as a woman. And at some point, that self-esteem is going to desert you, you know? But at that very moment where you're feeling bad about how you look, or you're feeling bad because you gained some weight, or you're feeling bad because, I don't know, you don't look the way you want to look, that's precisely the time you can give yourself compassion. You know, you can love, care for, and accept yourself regardless of your self-esteem at that moment, you know? I mean, and you can also get in touch with the fact that there are millions, billions of women who struggle the same way you do. And there's a certain sweetness, a certain satisfaction with feeling connected to all those women who, like you, are living the imperfection of life. You know, who we are is so unique and adds color and diversity to our lives. And if you can learn to celebrate that, and again, focus on your health and well-being, then it's not like looks won't matter, but they won't be nearly as important. Self-compassion blows me away because You're taking suffering in whatever cause and you're transforming it into love, connectedness, kindness, patience, understanding. And aren't those really, for most of us, the most important things in life?
That is the truth. And I love this book, Self-Compassion by Dr. Kristen Neff. Stop beating yourself up. Leave insecurity behind. Kristen, thanks so much for being on the show today. And I wondered if you could tell everybody a little bit more about your website and what's available and what you offer there.
Yeah, my website, I've really tried to make it user-friendly. You can test your own self-compassion level. I've got some videos where I explain what self-compassion is. I have all my research and other people's research on there. I have guided meditations. I have exercises. And of course, there's a link where you can buy the book. So the website is self-compassion.org. Although, if you forget the dash, I also own that domain name. So just even if you just Google self-compassion, it comes up. And most people have said it's a really rich resource. So if you're interested, please visit me.
It's a great book. It's called Self-Compassion, Stop Beating Yourself Up and Leave Insecurity Behind by Dr. Kristen Neff. I want to thank her again so much for being here, and thank you all for joining me. My name is Joe Davidson. This is Zentertainment Talk Radio on the web at zentertainment.org. This music in the background is by Maria Costellas from Flutes of the World. Have a good week. Peace.